Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Physicians for Healthy Communities, a physician-led organization that educates on the science of prevention to improve public health. Visit their website to learn how they prevent substance misuse while supporting individuals, families, and communities. Go to physiciansforhealthycommunities.org. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a collegial conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. Collegial, as in campus life in colleges and universities. Attending college and university is a special time in a young person's life. It's a time of personal growth and learning, and it's often the first time to live away from home. Freedom. Entering college is entering the adult world. Students view themselves as full-fledged adults, perhaps for the first time. Responsibility. However, when I talk to college students, I often ask for a show of hands. How many of you are under 25? Many hands go up. You may be college students, but your brain is still growing. With the growing brain, we know addiction is up to 7 times higher than someone my age. Knowing that scientific fact, it's ironic that alcohol and drugs are associated with the collegial world, a time of crucial brain growth. Simply search party school, and you'll find a ranking of the top party schools listed as a badge of honor, like the Ivy League of fun. Fraternities and sororities have a reputation for alcohol and drugs at parties, and sadly, that comes at a price. I recently was invited to the University of Missouri to give a series of lectures for the Three Deans series. Thank you and shout out to Dr. Richard Barron, M-I-Z-Z-O-U. While I was visiting, a 22-year-old student, Riley Strain, went missing while on spring break. My thoughts went to alcohol and marijuana as I saw that the people on campus were hurting. Weeks later, his body was recovered from the Cumberland River in Nashville. The news reported his alcohol level at 0.228%, higher than the 0.08 legal limit. But the news did not report something just as important, if not more important. His delta-9 THC was over 50 nanograms per milliliter. It was higher than the toxicology machine even tested for. It's the highest I have ever seen. Riley was drunk, but he was really, really, really high. The two together, alcohol and marijuana, are additive in their effect, and it's what killed Riley. May his memory be a blessing. To learn more about preventing alcohol and drugs in college students, I reached out to experts who developed a strategic plan to tackle that problem. Rich Lucy from DEA serves as Senior Prevention Program Manager at the Drug Enforcement Administration's Community Outreach and Prevention Support Section. Aaron Ficker serves as Regional Director in SAMHSA's Strategic Prevention Technical Assistance Center, SPTAC. She also serves as the prevention manager at the Great Lakes Prevention Technology Transfer Center, PTTC. They are both experts in drug and alcohol prevention. To learn more about Rich Lucy and Aaron Ficker and the Prevention with Purpose College Campus Guide, check out the High Truths show notes. Rich Lucy and Aaron Ficker, welcome to High Truths.
Hi, Dr. Lev. Great to be here.
Hi. Thanks. Yeah, thanks for having us.
That's great. It's been really important to get to the strategy and method of prevention at college campuses. It was a special request from master students at San Diego State to get education directly for college campuses. So I'm really glad that I was able to get you guys to join. And let's start with just a little background. Rich, you're a prevention specialist who works with DEA. How did that happen?
Yeah, wow. Okay, so I'll give you the Reader's Digest version because my experience is that anybody who's working in prevention got there through a long and winding road. There's very few times that it's a direct path. I started my professional career in my home state of New York, working for state government. I oversaw New York State's efforts to prevent alcohol and drug misuse among college students. In 1999, I became a federal employee. I started at the U.S. Department of Education. I was there for 9 years. Then I went to a part of Health and Human Services for 8 years. And then in 2016, DEA recruited me to come work here. And I'm in the Community Outreach and Prevention Support section, where a significant but not only part of my portfolio is working on our resources for professionals that are working to prevent drug use and misuse among college students.
So what's it like for you? Started with Department of Health, and now you ended up working for a law enforcement agency. What was that transition like for you personally?
Yeah, it definitely is a culture shift. My entire career, which is 3 decades plus at the government levels, has been in the prevention space. So every agency, whether it's state government or the three federal agencies, has been in the prevention space. So that's been the constant. But we're coming from education to Health and Human Services to now law enforcement, all different cultures that you have to navigate, but you do find your way and you do figure out ultimately what's the common goal, what's the common mission. And even though we are primarily a law enforcement agency, first and foremost, make no doubt about it, the work we do in community outreach and prevention support absolutely complements that work.
Right. I kind of think of like my husband who's a dentist, right? It's like, okay, he fixes teeth, but it's better to teach people to brush their teeth and not need the dental care in the first place.
Absolutely.
Aaron, what about you? You're in prevention work. You work with grants from SAMHSA. Tell us how that happened.
So like most people, I kind of fell into the prevention field. I ended up moving to Champaign-Urbana in central Illinois right after I had finished my master's degree.
Yeah, and I went to middle school in Urbana.
That's so amazing. Not a lot of people know where Champaign-Urbana is, so yep. I love that. And I learned to love that town after 3 years.
The Fighting Illini.
Yeah, the Fighting Illini. Yeah, we love it. My husband's an alumni twice over. So we moved there for him to go to school. I had no idea where I would land. I was just excited to like support him in his new venture. I was really, really lucky that I fell into a position at the University of Illinois Center for Prevention Research and Development, or lovingly called CPRD. It's an amazing center that's housed at the university that does prevention work in a lot of fields, but the majority of the work they do is in substance misuse prevention and is working with the state of Illinois. The position I came in to do was to work with, as an evaluator, of community level state funded prevention programs. I worked with them. I worked there for 3-4-ish years, did a number of different evaluation roles. I did a couple of research studies, and it was really fun. And I learned a lot about the field. I learned a lot about prevention. And I also learned that I wanted to do more than just evaluate and wanted to really support these communities to do work in the best way possible, right? And to support them to think through how to approach it. And so, again, in really just like a lucky move, I was recruited to come to the Prevention First in Illinois. There are a couple of Prevention Firsts in the country. This one is in Illinois. And we served as the training and technical assistance provider for the state of Illinois' block grant. So I worked with communities to help them, you know, do their work better, to understand the work. We did training. I provided direct technical assistance. I loved that work. Got to work with folks at the community level. After that, again, super lucky, got recruited to come to EDC, Education Development Center. And at the time, we held a large federal contract to provide training and technical assistance to the states for prevention. And so I got to work at the state level, working with people who are kind of at the top of prevention in their states. It was an absolutely amazing job, and I learned so much and had such an amazing experience. When that grant ended, I moved into a couple of different federal grants. Now I work on the Substance Strategic Prevention Technical Assistance Center. It's a new grant, or a new contract that is out of SAMHSA. We call it SPTAC, and we provide training and technical assistance to states and communities that receive grants directly from SAMHSA. So that's really exciting. I also have the opportunity to work on the Great Lakes Prevention Technology Transfer.
Lots of acronyms. I know it's hard.
Too many acronyms. So I work on the Great Lakes Prevention Technical.
PTTC.
PTTC. And that work is really to provide training and workforce development for everyone in the Great Lakes region, not just those who receive funding from SAMHSA. So I have my hands in a lot of different places.
That is great. And so both of you working in primary prevention and getting that across at various venues. I'm wondering if you feel like some of us that primary prevention is getting less attention than it should be.
Oh, I absolutely. I've been saying that, unfortunately, for the last 4 or 5 years, it's felt like we have gone further downstream in efforts. And it's not that those efforts aren't important. I mean, absolutely, when you look at treatment and recovery, absolutely, that's all part of the continuum. But it has seemed that at least in some colleges and university settings, in some communities, I will never paint it with a broad brush and say all. I never overgeneralize that, but it does feel like there's been a shift away from primary prevention, which is, you know, really where we do start our work and change norms. I know that for some, you know, that non-use message for those under the age of 21, whether you're talking alcohol or marijuana, for those states who have legalized it, you know, for personal non-medical use, as I call it, you know, the legal age is 21. You know, there seems to be kind of a shift away from that. But what we've learned from prevention science is to change the norms. You really, now is not a time to deviate from primary prevention. I used 2020 as a barometer, Dr. Liv, because we know that alcohol and drug use rates tend to go up during stressful times following a traumatic event. And we have seen that from you know, Hurricane Katrina to Florence. And certainly in 2020, there were studies that started to show after the pandemic that, sure enough, not only did drug rates tend to go up, but more mental health issues started to exacerbate. And so as I, you know, continue to promote, I'll always continue to promote, now is not the time to take your eye off of primary prevention. We need that focus. So I think that you're absolutely right in your observation that we seem to have gotten away from it just a bit, and you need to kind of refocus it and get back there.
Yeah, I think and you, Aaron, you can see if you agree too, because you're getting the grant so that you see that it is happening. But I feel like they're like you said, Rich, it's all important. Okay, you know, whether it's upstream, downstream, but if you don't put more emphasis on the primary prevention, we're continuing the pipeline and we're going to have more problems down the road. And so I think that I think we don't have the right balance right now, which is why we're not seeing the results that we should be seeing. And if we study tobacco and opioid prescriptions, we stopped that or really curbed it. It's not like ended completely, but we really curbed it and made a good effort in decreasing use and addiction upstream. And with prevention, we didn't treat our way out of those problems.
Yeah.
I hear this I hear this a lot from states and grantees across the country and those working in prevention, that there's a concern that we are moving too far away from primary prevention. In my work over the past 10 years, I've seen that. And we are always, and I'm always pushing in those conversations to focus what I describe as a parallel process, right? We have to address the kind of immediate concerning needs in our communities and talk about preventing through harm reduction efforts, through trying to reduce overdose deaths.
That's right, really right. No one's against naloxone. We got to have it everywhere.
And those are urgent needs.
Yeah.
But as you said, we can't ignore the upstream part. So we have to be able to find a way to stay in on parallel paths and not lose sight of primary prevention, which is going to kind of slow or stop the amount of use we see and the amount of concern we see downstream. So absolutely, I think that there's been a lot less of a focus, but I feel like I have a lot of hope as I see folks across the country in the community level and at the state level really calling out for that focus and really finding that in their work. So yeah, but it's hard to do both things at the same time.
Right. But that's why I'm so happy that you exist and people like you who are focused on that topic, right? I mean, there's people who do treatment, people who do, supply, but we need more people and more efforts, I think, in primary prevention. And that's what we're here for talk about. And what's interesting is I have two of you together. Rich, you're from, you're representing public safety, and Aaron, you're representing public health on a grand level. How is this, and on a government level, how is this connection made between DEA and SAMHSA?
So we are fortunate in our connections and collaborations with federal partners across the federal government. You know, we collaborate with our partners at the U.S. Department of Education in the Office of Safe and Supportive Schools, at SAMHSA in the Center for Substance Abuse Prevention, where I spent 8 years of my career and, you know, have lifelong friends and colleagues there. We look to NIDA and to NIAAA for the research part, you know, of this. We look to CDC and collaborate with them as well. So, you know, DEA, you know, people often will say, really? Prevention, DEA in prevention? Well, you know, as I like to say, we are no longer the best kept secret about DEA. The fact is, DEA has been in the prevention space for the better part of 30 years. And it, unfortunately, as often happens in our field, there was a catalyst, but the catalyst was a tragedy. And that was the kidnapping, torture, and murder of one of our special agents, Kiki Camarena, you know, back in 1985. And, you know, it was then that really raised the consciousness of the American people of how dangerous the work is of the men and women of DEA, you know, not only in the United States, but around the globe, you know, taking down drug trafficking organizations. But it was also at that same time that we saw the need to really raise awareness among the general, the general public across the country about the dangers of drug use. And so that's where the education efforts started. And our resources, our portfolio of prevention resources, have only continued to grow since that time 30 years ago. So we have such a robust portfolio of prevention resources now that are for parents, caregivers, teachers in K-12, professionals in higher education, different populations, the American Indian Alaska Native population. Now, you know, we're focused there, the workplace, so employers can have materials and resources for their staff. So we don't do it alone. We like to say that we look to our force multipliers, and those are for our partners at the federal level, state governments, and at the local level. And certainly, you know, with I've had a long affinity with EDC across my career, and so where Aaron works, and so the technology transfer centers and all of the training and TA centers that are around the country, you know, we all work with them, and that's how we continue to do the good work we do.
That's awesome. And Aaron, how about you with the connection with law enforcement working together?
You know, I can speak to partnerships with other government agencies really through the lens of how our clients and the grantees work. So at SAMHSA, our SAMHSA grantees at the state level have to work with partners across all parts of state government in order to really get the message out. And one of those is often law enforcement, and they work with them in different ways to help promote prevention, whether that's primary prevention or more of a harm reduction model. At the community level, it's essential that people are working with law enforcement. Law enforcement is really vital as a partner to promote prevention efforts at the policy level, on the social norms approaches. So we see those partnerships everywhere. And beyond law enforcement, we see partnerships at the state and community levels with other governmental agencies as well, including DEA. As part of my work at EDC, I work for a smaller component that we call Prevention Solutions, and that was how Rich and I were connected to do work together. So that was where we began our work together on bringing me into some work on higher education prevention. So there's lots of connections that, you know, the prevention field is small. At the federal level, it's small, but at the community level, it expands, and the more it expands, but to bring in law enforcement as a partner, I think the better that ultimately those communities do.
That's great. And I support that completely. I chair a committee in San Diego called Credo, Community Response to Drug Overdoses. And I say we bring together the three P's, public health, public safety for prevention. And I tell my law enforcement friends that they make me a better doctor because they help me know what's going on in the community that otherwise I wouldn't know.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's one of the things we do. We talk about collaboration and making connections, and we try to connect, you know, whether it's state level or community level schools, whether it's K-12 or college, we try to connect them with their local DEA office, because our 23 field divisions and ultimately our 200 plus offices around the country, they are the folks who are going to know the drug trends that are happening within a region, within a community. And so to help make those connections, absolutely, that's how you start to then know what's actually going on in your area. And as I always like to say, the data drives the programming. You have to know what to focus on, you know, whether it's cocaine, meth, fentanyl, and our DEA, you know, offices around the country can help local communities. So I'm glad that you brought that up, Dr. Lev. It's exactly, you know, what we try to help communities around the country do, is to know their local DEA office.
Yep. And they're powerful. And that's actually how I got connected into this in the whole, it really changed my field, because we had DEA agents come in with guns to our medical association meetings to educate us. And they had to, like, you know, had us, you know, take a breath, because we're not used to seeing law enforcement. It's usually something bad. But they were there to educate us on how we could be victims of fraud when it came to prescription drugs. And that was, you know, revolutionary in my career. And so I appreciate the work that DEA does in prevention. And so you guys, there's a lot of things in prevention, but you guys are focusing on college campuses. Why that focus?
Well, I'll give the short answer, and then I'm sure Aaron can expound on it. We know the 18 to 25 age group has some of the highest rates of drug use, and the national surveys bear that out. They also have some of the lowest rates of seeking help. And college students make up a significant portion of the 18 to 25 age group. And so when you look at the data, whether it's the Monitoring the Future study or the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, CDC even giving you a predictor like the youth, the YRBS, looking at that survey, the American College Health Association has their National College Health Assessment. You know, these are all national studies that we can look at that give us a real indication of you know, what drugs students are using, how much they're using. And as I said, they have some of the highest rates of drug use. And so it just seems like that's, you know, the natural population we should focus in on. And it's, again, it's a segment. And then you can slice the college population down even further, obviously to first year students, student athletes, members of fraternities and sororities, the LGBTQ plus population, you know, females versus males, and how much they're using, the differentiations there. So for us, it just seemed a natural fit to look at that age group.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. That is a good, I mean, there's many different targets. You could go upstream from college, but I think, because I always say addiction is a disease that starts in middle school, but I think that there is a big focus on college campus for a lot of people. It's the first time using drugs, the first time being free to do whatever you want. I think it's good to have that focus in helping these young adults make good decisions. So I thought what we'll do is from here go kind of like you guys developed a strategy, right? A strategic plan for college campuses. I'll go through the strategy of this podcast. We'll go the same way. We'll go through the data, the solutions, some examples, and then figure out how is this working. So let's start with the data. You said that there's a lot of data, a lot of surveys out there that are evaluating drug and alcohol use with college students. Can you take us through that? What is the data showing us?
So I'll hit on just three: alcohol, marijuana, and prescription drugs. So, you know, alcohol is not a controlled substance, so it's not necessarily within the purview of DEA. But like I said, I have said on many occasions, I can't talk about preventing drug use among college students without talking about what is still the number one drug of choice among college students, which is alcohol. For years, we have known that college students tend to binge drink more than their peers who are not in college. That was true all the way up until 2020. In 2020, those two data points converged because, as we know, schools shut down just like the rest of the world did. Students went back to their home environments, whatever that, you know, might look like. And then in 2021, what we thought would happen did, and that gap widened again, and college students were binge drinking more than their counterparts, not in college. There is good news in this, though, and I always like to, you know, share the good news. If you look at the Monitoring the Future study from last year, and it's due to come out with this year's data like any day now, you know, so we'll have new data very, very soon. But binge drinking among college students actually went down about 3 percentage points in 2021 to 2022. And, you know, that we talked earlier about primary prevention, that is absolutely a result of all the prevention work that's being done on college campuses, in their surrounding communities, from federal government, state government, right on down. So we need to take the moment to applaud the work that we're doing. So, you know, I also want to raise with alcohol, there is also another concerning behavior that's called high intensity drinking. So when I mentioned binge drinking before, you know, that's 5 or more drinks at a setting. High intensity drinking is 10 or more drinks at a setting. Now, in 2021, it was about 1 in 10 college students engaged in that behavior. 2022, it's now about 1 in 5. Still not a great number. I mean, we saw a decrease, so yay us. But the corollary I like to make around that, you know, that more than, you know, 10 drinks at a sitting, a colleague of ours, Dr. Jason Kilmer, out of the University of Washington, he had a slide at a presentation at a conference we were at this past January. And there was such this connection between 10 or more drinks and suicide that I now have to make that connection that for people who consume 10 or more drinks, increase their risk for suicide about 90 times more than those who don't engage in that behavior. So I think that that's an important thing that, you know, I always like to make that alignment, that connection between alcohol and drug misuse and mental health. So there's the alcohol piece. Marijuana, again, about 22% of college students are currently users of cannabis. So that's in the past 30 days. they've used cannabis. But that's down since 2019. So again, 22%, you know, one in five college students are using cannabis currently. We'd like to drive that number down even further. We'll see what the new data show us. But what I like to point out with the marijuana piece is a gender issue. For the longest time, college males were using cannabis in the past 30 days more than the females in college. Well, in 2021, the females caught up. And in 2022, they actually surpassed the males. It's about 4 percentage points. About 23% of college females currently use cannabis in the past 30 days, as opposed to about 19% of males. So I think that's an important gender differential that I like to point out for colleges and universities as they look at their data. Again, the national data is great to look at for a comparison point, but we can't stress enough the importance of colleges and universities and other settings as well, collecting their individual, their own data, because that's what's going to help indicate what they should focus on.
But that's a big deal, because we used to think that, no, but that's a big deal, the point that you're making with the gender, because cannabis and particularly marijuana used to be a male disease with consequences. And now you're saying that women are catching up in the use, which means we'll see the consequences catch up as well.
Exactly. Now, again, these data, we'll have a new set of data coming out within the next week or so, likely monitoring the future. These data that look at college students comes out in about August. And I know it comes out of the University of Michigan, funded by NIDA. And I happen to know it's in the next week or so that, you know, these new data will come out. So we'll see what it shows. But right now, we saw the women have surpassed the men, you know, in terms of the college students.
And last thing I'll put in. Before we go to the next drug, the combination of the two, I think, is important. I don't know if you read about the boy, Riley Strain, the college student from Missouri. And so, you know, the press reported, you know, he was found very sadly on spring break where he drowned. And they reported his alcohol levels at 0.228 or something. But they didn't report that his THC level was greater than 50. Greater than means like it was higher than their machines were capable of doing. So he was maybe a little drunk, but he was really, really, really high. And the two together, you know, are additive.
Absolutely. And thank you for bringing that up, because poly drug use now is probably more the norm than it is the exception. It's rare that somebody who is misusing a drug is only misusing one drug. You know, the connection between alcohol misuse and marijuana use, there's a pretty strong connection there. And then bringing in the prescription drug misuse, which that was the last drug I wanted to just mention. You know, in the general population, the three classes of prescription drugs typically misused are, in order, opioids, sedatives, and stimulants. But among college students, it directly inverts. And college students typically are misusing stimulants and then sedatives and then opioids. And I always say to folks, you know, we've had an opioid misuse issue in our country for the past 15 years. And just because opioids are likely third in the class of prescription drugs typically misused by college students, that doesn't mean it's not happening. You know, you point to, for example, not to overgeneralize again, but you point to, say, student athletes, the athletics departments, where sports injuries take place and pain management. That's an opportunity for potential misuse there. But what I like to bring up with the stimulant misuse is the college students who are significantly misguided in their belief that if I take a stimulant that's not prescribed for me,
an Adderall, a Vyvanse,
yeah, like Ritalin, like Adderall.
Right. We want to stay up and help study before my final tomorrow.
There you go. And that's why they call them study drugs. That's why they have been, you know, characterized as study drugs among college students. And we know there's no research, none, that shows the non-medical use of a prescription stimulant is going to help you get a better grade. But unfortunately, the misperception persists. And like other, you know, correction of misperceptions that work, professionals on college campuses and in the surrounding communities continue to, you know, focus in on that misperception. And, you know, we'll talk about fake pills and illicit fentanyl later, but there's definitely a connection between.
No, there is, because you could be studying in the library for finals, taking your what you think is a Ritalin and be found dead in the library. And it's happened.
Yes, absolutely. So those are the quick data points that I want to mention on three of the drugs.
Right. And that's really important. And then, you know, and then DA has I've seen one of your slides, Rich, about fake pills, that 7 out of 10 pills that the DA tested were fake.
Yeah, contain a lethal dose of fentanyl. Last year, it was 6 out of 10. And a few years even before that, it was 4 out of 10. And so what we're seeing now is absolutely that 7 out of 10 number. This issue around fake pills and illicit fentanyl is unlike anything I've seen in 3 decades plus in this field. It really has changed the game a lot. I mean, it's absolutely a public health and public safety issue. So yeah, 7 out of 10, that's where a lot of our efforts are focused in on right now. And Dr. Levy, you mentioned it. Aaron and I have talked about this on plenty of, whether in a workshop together or just in phone conversations. The student who thinks, again, you know, they think if they take an Addy and it's going to help them get a better grade and they're not getting it, it's not prescribed for them by a licensed provider and dispensed through a trusted pharmacy. And oh, by the way, a social media site is not a trusted pharmacy. You know, that's the universal message that we are trying to get across with our One Pill Can Kill campaign, is never take any medicine that hasn't been prescribed for you by a licensed medical provider through a trusted pharmacy. But unfortunately, you know, the college student who has a test coming up and their roommate says, you know what, let me score you an Addy. It's going to help you study better. You'll get a better grade. But where does that student get that Addy from? 3 or 4 people removed and a dealer, it makes its way back to the college student who takes it. And as you said, and unfortunately, I've had to have heartbreaking conversations with moms and dads and others over the last couple of years. And this is happening. We know it's happening on college campuses. They thought they were taking a Percocet. They thought they were taking an Adderall. They thought they were taking a Xanax. And, you know, all it takes is that 2 milligrams, which is enough to fit on the tip of a pencil. You know, people see that visual. It's not much.
Right, right. And it's very sad because a lot of people who are dying from drugs now, I don't think we have the number on that. We should by this time. But some people have a substance use disorder, but some people don't. They just made a mistake, a fatal mistake.
Yeah. And that's why we often use the term drug overdoses and drug poisonings, because, you know, there are people who they thought they were taking something else. It was a student. They don't have a substance use disorder. It was just that one time. And that one time was unfortunately one too many times. And through, you know, that's a poisoning. That's what's happening, unfortunately, right now in our all around the country with the issue around fake pills and illicit fentanyl.
Yeah. And just a thing about social media, you mentioned different emojis and ways, and I don't know if this is probably not your expertise, your prevention, but I'm sure DEA is involved in trying to stop the sale of drugs through the internet and social media and various apps. And I just got a thing.
Anybody with a smartphone, that's what I, you know, say. Yeah. Anybody now with a smartphone.
Yeah, this is your drug dealer.
Fortunately, yeah. And we talk about the internet as being, you know, the new superhighway of drug trafficking. And a lot of these fake pills are being sold and transacted over social media sites. You know, we know that that's the case. And when you mentioned the emojis. So I want to make sure I get out. As we talk about education and the need to raise awareness, if people go to DEA.gov/onepill, That's where you can find all the resources about this issue. And there's a toolkit on there that has plenty of fact sheets on this issue. And one of those fact sheets is the emoji, you know, drug codes. And right now, that's how people are communicating on their smartphones using emojis to, you know, convey the need to score a Xanax or a Percocet. So we put that fact sheet out to help decode that so that parents, other caregivers, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, classmates, teammates, and roommates all are equipped with this information. Because, you know, we in prevention, and Aaron and I talked about this before, you know, in prevention, we always feel like we're playing catch up sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so we need to try and stay as either in step or a step ahead. And that's unfortunately not the place we're usually in. And the emoji codes, it feels like that sometimes too.
You know, it's interesting that you say that we're trying to play catch up, because I think that we feel that way because we go by the drug. Okay, today it's, you know, it was prescription pills one day, now it's fentanyl, and now we got the fake Xanaxes and the Adderalls. If we moved prevention, primary prevention, not just to the drug, but moved it upstream to mental health and resiliency and started earlier, like in elementary school, then we'd be ahead. What do you think?
Absolutely.
Aaron, take it.
Yeah. 100%. And that's where we want to be. So there's a number of different approaches that we focus on, like the social development strategy, which is focused on building resiliency across the board among youth. And it is, it starts in much younger, focuses on protective factors as opposed to risk factors, and building those up in youth. For communities, we encourage them not to be distracted by what we refer to as the drug of the day, right? Because we have limited resources, we have limited people. So that's why, you know, Rich talked about the data and the importance of having data that's specific to your campus or specific to your community. Keeping that data, collecting that data, and really knowing what's happening in your community. In most communities, what we're seeing is still the highest drug of use is alcohol. And so when we talk about polysubstance use, when we talk about alcohol being present in so many of these overdose deaths, we know that getting to that issue early can be really helpful. So we want to make sure that we are helping communities use data to make decisions about their prevention programming so that they can really have the most impact possible. And again, this is where I think there's a parallel approach. What's the most pressing issue? What is the most prevalent issue that we would say, you know, so if it's youth alcohol use, but then what's the one that has the greatest severity? And can we address both of those at the same time? And often that's really difficult. So the most severity might be unintentional drug overdoses. And how do we address both of those? But it's all about the data. If you're not seeing those in your community, focus where you see those biggest impacts in your community. And that's where you're going to have the impact. That's where you're going to make change.
Right. Well, I mean, you're right. The thing that's going to kill people on the spot with that, you know, 2 grains of fentanyl will kill it, and fentanyl is extremely lethal. We have to have naloxone everywhere and teach about fentanyl. But if we don't want to have this problem 10 years down the road, we have to go to elementary schools and do that type of education. It's funny. I'm a grandma, and I went to my granddaughter's 2-year-old like little birthday party at the preschool, and I noticed one of the signs that they had on the wall is, if you're frustrated, what do? You could take a walk. You could take a breath. These are for 2-year-olds, and I'm thinking we need this continuously throughout education.
Absolutely. And that's so many of our community level prevention providers across this country are at that level. They are working in elementary schools. They are working in middle and high schools to really educate kids on to address the risk factors, some of which have nothing to do with drug use, but have everything to do with connecting to the community, being connected to schools, having a trusted adult, these factors that we know support kids. And we also are focusing on those, you know, the communities are focusing on social emotional learning. And that's a big component of some of these curriculums that are out there. They're not just, these are the drugs, say no. It's really about building that resiliency, building the skills, and an understanding around the perception of use, your understanding of your peers. There's a lot more depth and richness to what's happening.
Social emotional learning. I like that.
It's really exciting. And more the curriculums we see at the younger levels are more around the protective factors and building up that resiliency.
Wow. So more acronyms. SPF, Strategic Prevention Framework. Okay.
It's not the sunscreen. We're not talking about sunscreen. No.
Yeah. SPS level. What is that? This is the strategy you guys developed specifically for, from what I understand, college campuses to do prevention work. Is that right? Or tell us more about that.
Yeah. Amber, why don't you start with what the SPF is, and then I'll talk about how and why we brought it specifically mm-hmm. to colleges and universities.
Absolutely. So the Strategic Prevention Framework was created actually by folks at SAMHSA 20 plus years ago.
20 years this year, actually.
Is it this year?
It's 20th anniversary is this year, yeah.
Wow.
That means that I've been in prevention 20 years this year, because I was part of that first round of grantees. So the Strategic Prevention Framework was created as a model, a strategic planning model, to really create intentional prevention. It was rolled out at the state level. It rolled down to the community level. And it's a tool that helps folks move through a process that is intentional. It's data informed. It focuses on capacity, which I think is really important, around making sure your community is ready to address the problem, that you have the resources, the staffing on board. So it focuses on capacity and planning, using that data to make decisions. It also focuses on what we know about implementation science. What's the best way to implement these programs and select them? And then evaluation. There's also a center component of it, which focuses on sustainability, making sure that the programs that you're doing and the outcomes that you're reaching are sustained in your community. And then lastly, one on it's cultural competence or cultural humility, but ensuring that that's ingrained in all the steps. There's a million different models for strategic planning. This is the one that SAMHSA has adopted and promoted, and it's my favorite, not gonna lie. And I think it's really successful. It's really accessible. So we see communities use it. We promote it in everything that we do to support communities. It's in almost every presentation.
It's 20 years. That means this was established before the whole fentanyl crisis. Does it still apply even with this crisis?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. It's evergreen. It doesn't matter.
Because you're looking at your own data, whether that's the state's data or the community's data, that's going to come up. And then in your planning process, you're going to say, okay, which of these problems, and you're going to, we encourage people to prioritize problems based on, is it getting worse? How severe is the problem? How prevalent is it? And the magnitude of the problems. And so we ask people to think about those components, select what they can move forward with, what they can address with the risk factors and the protective factors that they can address directly. So if fentanyl comes up as one of those priority substances, where there's capacity, readiness, and there are risk and protective factors that can be addressed in your community, then we definitely see people selecting that as a substance that they'll address through their selection and implementation of prevention programs. They may select other issues like underage drinking or prescription drugs. What are they called? Prescription drug misuse. So the model really isn't to do any one kind of substance with any one kind of group. It's really intended to help you know what's happening in your community and how you can address.
So who is using this? Is this college campuses using it? Is it public health agencies using this? Or
So states use the model at the, you know, the state level. We see prevention offices using it and promoting it with their grantees. We see communities using it. SAMHSA promotes it in their grant making to encourage folks to use it. So it's happening really at every level of prevention, and it's promoted at every level of prevention. So whether wherever your funding comes from or whatever's driving your work, the SPIF is going to be behind it. So college campuses are encouraged to use it. And Rich, I mean, really should speak to the promotion of the SPIF on college campuses and how he's working to move that forward.
Okay. So one of the things that's been our, you know, the backbone of us developing our resources is we don't want to be duplicative of what other agencies are doing. We always want to fill a gap. You know, we want to put something out there that doesn't exist. And in 2019, as we started to think about what other resources we could put out there to help support the professionals working on this issue, I pulled a group of people together that work on college campuses, and I, you know, basically had a meeting with them, and I said, let's brainstorm this. What resources aren't out there? What could you use to help support you in your work? And by and large, the number one thing they said was a strategic planning guide. There's no guide out here that's up to date, that's current, that's produced by a federal agency that's specifically for our needs. Okay, I heard them loud and clear. And as I started to think about what that was going to be, I kept coming back to the SPIF. Now, I had joined the feds in 1999. The SPIF debuted in 2004, so it'd already been 5 years. But I've known for the longest time how useful it is for states and communities that use this roadmap to help guide them in their efforts. So I kept coming back to the SPIF and I said, you know what does not exist is a strategic planning guide that aligns the strategic prevention framework with prevention on college campuses. And that's how Prevention with Purpose, our strategic planning guide that we published initially in January of 2020, came about and resoundingly was received with positive reviews because, as I said, we didn't want to be duplicative. We wanted to fill the gap that wasn't out there, that existed. Resources that weren't out there. And, you know, when this debuted, the colleges and universities ate it up. I mean, individual colleges and universities were using the SPIF, but there wasn't a concerted guidebook for colleges to turn to. And now that we've updated it, we've revised it through Aaron's great leadership and you know, at EDC, subject matter expertise. You know, we published the updated guide in 2024. And again, it's being very well received by the college and universities focused on this. I just want to quickly say, Dr. Lev, you brought it up before. In our business, we know we chase the drug. That's what we call it. You know, it's and we know sometimes it's on coke, sometimes it's heroin, sometimes it's illicit fentanyl. The beauty of the SPIF, and I'm going to absolutely plagiarize and steal Aaron's phrase here. The beauty of this model is it doesn't matter what substance you're focused on based on what your data is telling you, the SPIF will be your roadmap. So that's why it's so helpful to have this guide and this roadmap, regardless of what your local data are telling you, use that data and use the strategic planning framework to get you to where you know, ultimately get you the results you want.
And that is called, is it Prevention with Purpose? Is that what people who are college campuses?
That's our strategic planning guide. And now we have 11 supplements for different populations on campus. These very brief 4 to 12 page for very specific faculty members, campus police, working with students, focus now on our newest one, student athletes. It basically, you know, it's a supplement to Prevention with Purpose. That's exactly what it's for. You know, that's why I said we're putting something out there that didn't exist, and we have filled that gap, and we're just very happy with the way it's being used around the country.
When you say that campuses are eating it up, who is it that says, okay, we want to bring this to our campus? Is it coming from the campus, you know, the president of the university? Is it coming from prevention folks in the university? I don't know if all universities even have that.
So it's mainly that. It's the the folks who are, you know, there used to be a time when prevention on a college campus, that was predominantly your work, you know, like 90% of your work. That's rarely the case anymore. Like with so many of us, we wear very different hats. But it's either out of the health center, the staff out of the counseling center, or staff out of student affairs. And these are the professionals who are have been tagged to work on the prevention part of their efforts on campus. And these are the folks who are gravitating toward this guide, which is useful whether you've been in the field for a long time like I have, or if you're new, and we've got a lot of new entry-level people that don't really know what prevention science is and everything that goes along with that. And this guide, you know, the 70 to 90 pages that it is, really gives them the necessary framework and foundation they need to do productive work in this space.
Awesome. Okay. So it comes, there is groups on campus. You said student affairs,
the health centers, counseling
health
centers.
Center, counseling center. Okay. Yeah. They're the ones who will be reaching out to promote that. I'm wondering, is one of the things that I've learned through this experts who come to the podcast is the importance, and I think, Aaron, you mentioned it, social norms. When we talk in prevention and in the drug world, we'll say, oh my gosh, we have so many people are binge drinking or using marijuana or using drugs, or these are people who are dying. But we don't say, which is what kids need to hear, and kids means college kids too, is that most people don't use, right? That's the social norm. We're not, and so I've learned that if I'm addressing, you know, if I'm addressing government or I'm trying to get a, you know, program started, then I'll say, oh, this problem is terrible. But if I'm addressing, students, young people, I promote the social norm. And I'm wondering if that's a big emphasis in the guide.
Yeah, absolutely. And addressing social norms, we want to do across the board, right? We want to do that in with young kids and all the way through with adults, because there is this perception that everyone uses. And that really kind of lends some like, well, you know, I'll jump on that bandwagon. So decisions made with misperception of norms can be dangerous. And so there's all kinds of different approaches to how we correct those norms, how we help people see that. And so much that this is why the data is so important. Like, I can't underscore this enough. Like, the data is so essential. When you have data that shows on your campus that a minority of students are using, right? So it's under 50%, then you can promote and reconnect to that norm and show people. But if you don't have the data, it's kind of a guess, and it's harder for people to buy into. So any way that we can talk to folks about most youth, or, you know, in high schools, we say, you know, most youth don't use, and we can say, you know, 77% of high school of kids in your school reported that they didn't drink alcohol. On college campuses, we can say the majority of students do not drink five or more drinks at a time, and we can promote that those things. So I can't say enough how important social norming is, and it's just one of the tools that we have, but it is really essential. And on college campuses, I think it can be exceptionally powerful.
Yeah. One of the things I learned also from NIAAA's data is that the concept of at-risk drinking is that, you know, if you do have, you know, five or more, then you're now an at-risk drinker. You know, you have to, you know, you're meeting that definition. And marijuana too, because it seems like kids go to college, it's like, oh, everybody's using marijuana. It's like, no, most people don't. Most people are making the choose, you know, they're thinking of their future and they're not using. I want to go through some examples. You have, so from this framework, you know, that applies to all, you have it specifically for college campuses. That's prevention with purpose. And there's also specific, I think, examples like campusdrugprevention.gov. And I'll have all these for our listeners, all these resources. I'll mention them. I'll have them in the show notes. But can you give us some examples of programs that campuses adopted?
Yeah, let me quickly mention, and I want to punt it to Aaron. You mentioned the website, campusdrugprevention.gov. We launched that in 2017. again as a resource that didn't exist. We heard from the field again. They needed a one-stop shop for resources that focused on all the drugs, predominantly more than alcohol, because NIAAA has a website and focus on that. We don't ignore alcohol, but you know, we wanted a website that focused on the other drugs, and that was focusing predominantly on prevention. So we launched that in 2017. When we created the first version of the guide, and now I think even more clearly in the revised version from 2024, Erin and her team interviewed colleges and universities from around the country to talk about specific strategies they have taken all along the five steps of the SPIF. And we wanted to highlight them to give people examples of things that they could do. One of my favorite is the prevention Shark Tank. I mentioned that that one of the campuses is using, you know, as a spinoff, takeoff, if you will, from the TV show. But Erin, why don't you talk about like kind of that process and things you learned or found with what campuses are, you know, successes and challenges with the SPIF.
Absolutely. Shark Tank is one of my favorites too, but I have had like just the unbelievable opportunity to interview so many people across campuses, across the country to learn about their prevention work, to write those and build those supplement documents that Rich talked about, but also the new updated guide. So if we think about the different steps in the SPIF, we know that there are a number of ways that people kind of in each one of those steps do things differently. We have a great example in one state where the state's coalition of prevention providers at college campuses in their state. So it's a coalition of college prevention professionals and schools, and they support them to do data collection. So they help bring the survey, they help college campuses plan for the promotion of that survey and the administration of that survey and even the analysis of the data, because it's a big lift. So having someone who's doing that, that's their specialty, and then can provide that support. So that's one great example of ways that we see innovation in how to get that data. In capacity building, there's all kinds of good stories about how folks have really shown leadership at the schools and different whether it's law enforcement at the school or faculty members, to really show them the urgency of the issues, the importance of them, and how they impact them. So there have been, you know, some examples of schools who've taken high-level administrators out at 1 o'clock in the morning to see what's going on. There have been really, you know, examples of prevention professionals who bring cross-tabbed data to say, look, these are our high-level drinkers, and this is academic performance, and what we see is a disconnect. One of the other ways to kind of get people on board that I've heard is really talking about legacy at the school. So if the school's legacy, as alumni, we're all connected to our schools, right? That's something that's like part of our identity. And when a school starts to have high profile.
The reputation.
Okay. Yeah, when they have a reputation or high profile incidences, it really starts to impact the way that the university is seen. And so that can be damaging to the relationship between alumni. It can be damaging to recruitment. So when you can sell that kind of stuff and that importance to leadership, then you really can start to get them to back prevention and support it in the community. So those are some great examples. We've seen all kinds of ways that schools are implementing different programs, whether those are alternative activities. So what are some stress-reducing activities that they can do during finals week? So I talked to a school who had, I can't remember what they called it, but it was very funny. And they had like a table of Legos. And it was like, just sit and play for a while, you know, and it was a way to say, let's help folks reduce stress during this time of what might be high drinking or high prescription drug use. So offering those kind of alternative activities.
My daughter's had a little therapy dog go through during final weeks.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that lovely? So also during high periods of drinking, we see folks doing alternative activities to, you know, Halloween. There was a school I spoke with and they had a huge carnival. And it was obviously an alcohol and drug-free environment. And they started it late at night. And they kept it going to into the morning hours when bars and restaurants were open and serving. And so it was a way to bring people in and give them an alternative activity to being out and drinking. So finding those points, whether it's St. Patrick's Day or Halloween. And then we've also seen folks doing those social norms campaigns and really supporting kids and youth or students to reach out for help. So we also see health centers who are working with prevention to say, we see this connection. So when we have someone come in and report substance use, that person, because we know that drug prevention is suicide prevention, that when you see someone come into your health center with substance use, that person gets the attention that they need as quickly as they can. So what we see there is this education of your health center and your health providers about those relationships and about the importance of supporting prevention in the health center. So let's get the health center promoting safe activities and prevention and social norms and really bringing all the partners in. So there's a billion ways and they're really unique to different schools.
So you're saying this is more than just a poster, right? Like the DEA's one pill can kill. I saw like one of the things on your slides was the police car with the one pill can kill message on the police car. But what you're describing is more than just a poster, right?
Absolutely.
It's a whole program.
Absolutely. And a social norms campaign can't be a poster. It can't be just one message. It has to be integrated into the way we talk about it. It has to be integrated into all the partners on campus. So you have to have the health center, faculty, athletic directors, coaches. You have to have resident hall leadership. You have to have everyone on that campus singing the same song, that this isn't what everyone's doing, that they can promote that through conversation. Every place they go, there should be information about that. The health center should be sharing that information. So there should be really no space, right, between folks on campus and the messages that we're sharing. So part of social norming is educating partners. It's educating students. Sometimes a poster is very effective. Sometimes a car wrapped is very effective. But what we do know is effective is peer conversations. So peer leaders. So we have peer educators who are out there having conversations with their peers about this too. So it has to be integrated into the culture and people have to continue to see those numbers. And hopefully those numbers continue to drop and understand that this truly is a minority of students. And there really is great ways to make better choices on campus.
Right. It's interesting because if you're looking for school, you're like a, you know, graduating high school, and you want to go to college. People actually look up party schools, right? But parents want safe schools, right? So it's interesting that you're having carnivals and big events that are alcohol and drug, specifically alcohol and drug free.
And that just gets to the legacy, right? How is our school seen in the public eye? So that really can help get leadership.
But do schools want to get rid of their party reputation, or do they like that?
Rich, I would.
It's.
I mean, you go to a football game and it's like rah rah rah. You know.
That's a whole other issue. In that, you know, schools are proud of their school spirit. I mean, that's what it comes down to. But that's what makes our work in this space challenging, too. I mean, when you have basically either denial out of true ignorance or denial out of we're just not going to talk about this issue, you know, and that does exist K-12 right on up through colleges and universities. You know, we know of instances where folks will collect the data, do a survey, collect the data, and then it just sits on a shelf and it doesn't go anywhere because the administration doesn't want the numbers to get out because they don't want people to think we've got a drug problem.
I've seen that, and, you know, at public health, like we don't want our pediatric marijuana poisonings data to be out there because we don't want to shame parents. It's like, wait a second, you need, the data is important.
Yeah, I always say to folks, you know, it's never about you do a survey, you collect it, and you get your numbers, and then you just release the numbers. It's never about that. It's release the numbers and say, you know what? We've noted we have an issue here that we need to.
This is an opportunity. This is an opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. It's never a here's the data, period. It's here's the data, comma, and what we're going to do about it.
And connecting it to risk and protective factors is really essential. It's, we have this problem and we, the data shows that what's driving it is X, Y, or Z. And we're going to address those things. Addressing alcohol use among youth or addressing marijuana use to folks who aren't in prevention, that sounds really overwhelming. How are we going to do that? This isn't my fault. I'm just scared. I just don't want to, right? If we just kind of back up from that in kind of fear. But if we can say to them, we're going to address the risk and protective factors. Mm-hmm. We're going to slow the things that are influencing these.
That also sounds overwhelming. How do you do that?
So the data will come back and say things, you know, we ask basically that why. So what's happening and why is it happening? So we may see that what is happening is we have a high level of high intensity drinking in a community and on a college campus, because those, you know, those two things are kind of inextricably linked. And what we'll see is it's, they're getting underage drinkers or they're being overserved in bars near campus. Okay, so we have a retail access problem. We have a server problem. There are very clear approaches to how we address that. We can come in and say, let's do retail beverage server training. We can change fines and penalties for stores that serve underage. We can have more law enforcement in those areas at that time. There's all kinds of really specific policy.
Can you what about dry campuses? Is that something?
That's Rich, I'll have you take that one.
So again, we do know that there are campuses that take that approach, and you know, it's worked for them. Then there are times, and certainly not mentioning schools, that say, you know, we're a dry campus, wink wink. I mean, it's like, you know, are you or are you not? It's truly, what is the administration going to get behind, help support, you know, and do that? The whole idea of, you know, drug-free residence halls, you know, for a long time, the recovery residence halls. Sometimes it started as just a floor, you know, in a residence hall. And now you have entire, and that's how, another indication of how our field has shifted, say, in the recovery movement, is as much as there is stigma around the issue, there is now also acceptance, you know, that people live with this disease, because we do know that addiction is a disease. So now you have campuses that have entire residence halls that are, you know, sober housing, as they call it, or different names, you know, the recovery housing. And, you know, students want to sign up for that for any number of reasons. They don't, you know, some students certainly are in recovery and that's why they want to stay in that type of a residence hall, for example. Other students, they don't want to be in an environment where it's just loud music, you know, what everything that comes with living in a common living arrangement. And so for academic purposes, or they just don't use, they just don't like the taste of it, they don't want to be around drugs at all. You have those students who also take advantage of that. So one thing we have learned is no one approach is the panacea. It will always be, it'll always come down to comprehensive approaches that are science-based and evidence-informed. And, you know, we'll take it back to the, you know, prevention with purpose. that's the beauty of the guide, is that guide can be all things to all people, because it's going to help guide you whatever your local issue is. And so I will always focus in on, it's never one approach. It's not about one size fits all and cookie cutter, because we know that that doesn't exist. It's got to be a comprehensive approach.
Right. So now let's circle back with the, you know, seeing like, where are these plans being implemented? How do we know that they're successful? So kind of the evaluation of this guide. So how many campuses around the United States are taking you up on the on using this prevention with purpose?
So we don't track that. I mean, we don't track, you know, in that case. So what I'm going to explain is just what I see, both from like the number of orders for the publication and then the conversations I have with our colleagues around the country. For example, there are states that have state conferences that are focused on this issue of preventing alcohol and drug misuse among college students. They will order, say, 100 copies of the guide because they're going to—
Can you give us an example? You know, some states will
Yeah, New York State, Michigan.
Nice.
Louisiana, Missouri, Ohio. So, I mean, there are, you know, I'm not just saying some to be, you know, big, but those are specific examples. You know, I'll say, you know, my home state of New York, I know and love it very well, but I also know the SUNY administration, the 64 plus schools around the state. They have ordered the guide. They have regular professional development opportunities for those alcohol and other drug prevention coordinators on those campuses, you know, each month or each quarter. They've ordered the guide so that they can make sure every coordinator has one on those campuses. So there's a school system-wide approach to this. So, you know, we do rely on, you know, individuals who are the folks leading prevention on campuses telling us, yeah, I use the guide all the time. It's my desk reference. It guides the work that we do. It really does rely on the campus to do their, what is it, last step of the SPIF evaluation. You know, the guide is the roadmap. You know, ultimately, it comes down to how well it's implemented, planned, and evaluated on the campus or in the community.
That's great. So I think it's a great program. I would love to, if I speak on campus, be able to give people resources like, hey, this is what the campus should be doing if you aren't already doing that. What is it that every college and university should know?
Well, first of all, they should know our website. So campusdrugprevention.gov, that's the one-stop resource. And then part of the, certainly part of the website, are the all of our publications as well as our federal partners publications. And certainly the guide, they can get it in print copy. They can also download it, you know, the digital version at no cost. All of our materials are at no cost. They can download it there. But I always say your one-stop resource is go to campusdrugprevention.gov.
That's great. And Aaron, what about you? What should everybody know?
I think they should know that there's a place to start and there are people to support them. So campusdrugprevention.org, the documents there, there are people in their state, there are other campuses. It's often isolating to do prevention work on campus, but there are a lot of people out there. And the more you connect to them and learn from them, I think the better off your prevention work will be.
That is awesome. I think that's very important work. I really thank you for what you're doing. We need this on campus. It's a good target audience. Again, most people go to school, their brain is not done developing. You were mentioning 21 is a legal age. Say 25 or 27 is a science age. So really thank you for joining us and the information. I'll have your resources in the show notes. Rich, Lucy, and Aaron Ficker, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us,
thank
Dr.
you. Thanks for having us. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Physicians for Healthy Communities. Visit physiciansforhealthycommunities.org and view their video and resource library. High Truth's producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.